When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, dear listeners of the Mad Scientist Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Cogswell, here with my co-host, Marie Mayhew. Marie.
What's going on? What's the story?
How you doing?
I'll tell you, next time, I know I say this like every single time we go in deep on a subject. Next time we have to do butterflies and rainbows and kitties again, man, because this is like intense.
Yeah.
The stuff on the Unabomber is intense, and it's like, it's dark and it's intense. It's really, really fascinating. And it's also, you know, again, it sort of makes you question a lot of the stuff that was happening at this time period, but then even still now, as if we need to question anything else in today's modern society, you know, got this on top of it now.
There's just so much there that makes it, makes it hard to, just makes it hard to wrap your head around kind of the testing that we did, the way that science has kind of progressed, and and kind of, you know, we think about we're standing on the shoulders of giants when we're in science, but in some ways too, we're, you know, in some ways we're not all those giants were friendly. You know, not all those giants were good people. So it's a little,
it's seeming like less and less.
Yeah. So it's a little
the more rough roads you have me travel down, Cogs, I swear to God.
Yeah.
The more my faith in humanity just gets that extra shake. That's great. Thank you.
It's a little rough. All right. So this episode, we're going to talk about Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, and his general Harvard milkiness, which is what I'm going to call this episode. Thought of it the other day, laughed to myself for a long time, and it's what we're sticking to, so I'm excited.
Aw, I liked a hell of a time at Harvard.
Oh, hell of a... Okay, fine, we'll do hell of a time at Harvard. That's fine, too. Hashtag Team Milkiness. All right, Jake, roll the tape. Okay, so Marie.
So Chris.
Unabomber goes to college. Baby's day out. We're doing it. We're finally here. We're at Harvard.
It seemed like such a great idea, right? I mean, brilliant mind. Sure, he's a little reclusive. He's quiet. He's a little quote unquote strange. But, you know, that's because he's just so smart.
Right.
So let's, you know, he's 16. Let's send him to, you know, he's got a scholarship to one of the most prestigious universities in the world. Why wouldn't you do that?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny in doing the research for this. Every single source I read, I wish that I had read it at the start of the series.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like everything I'm like, oh, that would have been a cool thing to bring up then.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I got from an article that we're going to be quoting a lot here, and it's actually from, it is from Alston Chase from June 2000. An article from The Atlantic called Harvard and the Making of the Unabomber.
Right.
And so Marie, you actually started reading.
Found this book. Yes, it is Alston Chase, Harvard and the Unabomber, The Education of an American Terrorist. And it is not electronically accessible, so you actually have to buy the paper book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, really in depth. So the author interviewed and had correspondence with Kaczynski. And while it's mostly about, I would say like the second half is about Harvard, it's so much about the FBI, his childhood, how he, you know, kind of framed all of his thoughts and started to work on his manifesto. And I can only read, it's fascinating, but I can only read like a little bit at a time because it's also really uniquely disturbing in that this man had this very scientific method about, like, they have snippets that I will read later in the, like, the next episode about his trial and error with killing people with the bomb.
Right, a very scientific approach generally to life.
Yes.
Which was kind of instilled in him at Harvard. What's cool about the book and that article especially, and if you want a taste of what the book is like, I suggest reading that article. It's really great. It's still available for free online through The Atlantic. So this guy, Alston Chase, actually was at Harvard around the same time as Kaczynski. I think he said he entered like 2 years after he graduated. Mm-hmm. And he actually had kind of the same feelings as Kaczynski, you know, and so when the Unabomber bombing started happening, he was kind of like, man, I kind of agree with this guy. Like, Alston, he actually moved to Montana, not like, I think he said 60 miles south of where Kaczynski's cabin was with his wife, for him and his wife to live isolated in the woods. You know, like, it's wild that he really had a kinship with Kaczynski and then actually became, you know, again, friends, I think, is a hard word for someone like Kaczynski, but at least became correspondence, right? Wrote to him quite a bit in when he was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so he starts off, Kaczynski starts off in Harvard. He's in the class of 1962. But if you remember, he joins at the age of 16 is when he gets to Harvard. And actually, so in further researching and stuff, the parents, like friends of the family and teachers that Kaczynski knew and was friendly with in high school and had good relationships with, warned the parents that this was a bad idea. Warned them that, you know, you're pushing Ted too hard. He's like, it's great. He got into Harvard, whatever. Give him another couple years before he goes, because he's clearly something's a little, you know, we just don't think it'll be good for him. Whatever, right? They just had a feeling. Or
he needs to emotionally mature.
Exactly, right. And that's the word that they keep using, right? He's intellectually, he's way out there, but maturity-wise, he's still just a kid, you know? And so it's fascinating to me that, you know, in the first episode, we touched on this kind of dualism between the view Kaczynski had of his childhood and the view that David and his mother kind of pushed out there about him. Mm-hmm. And they made this narrative that Kaczynski was insane. But then in reading quotes from his teachers and his friends in high school last episode, and then even towards in Harvard, you know, the evidence almost for Kaczynski's point of view towards his childhood kind of starts to add up, you know, which to me was a little shocking. I didn't expect it to kind of build as strong a case in my own mind, I guess. You know, and at least for the idea that he was being pushed out there before he was ready. Right. And now whether or not that was happening because of his parent, you know, his view is that this was happening because his parents only cared about his brain, only cared about, you know, showing the neighbors and being the best family. Right. Being the most prestigious family in the block. Our son went to Harvard at 16. Right. Versus a family that just genuinely didn't know how to deal with a kid who was a genius. But so.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think really quickly, I think that that's where you go back and forth on, because it's still like, well, how accurate is any one view, right? How accurate is his view on his own life and his own being? Because he's not, I would say he's not the most reliable narrator either, right? Like his parents and his family were like, hey, this is, you know, again, they didn't necessarily have a prideful or boastful when, you know, I think it's like it meets somewhere in the middle is what my imagine, you know, is what I imagine is actually closer to the truth. Because, yeah, if you read it from him, he's like, and the accounts that that people are like, hey, you know, he's not ready for this yet. But I don't know. I also think, well, it's like you think that it's, again, it's like in their best interest. It's not it's from what I was reading on in in the other book that his brother wrote, it was really that they wanted what was best for him. And they just thought that, you know, like anything else, he will adapt, or maybe right. will even help him adapt more. But then you read like that this was about their ego and about them wanting to be the most, you know, again, the most prestigious, and this will bring prestige to his family. And it's like that sort of back and forth. I mean, I can imagine.
Well, it's kind of what all
it's like him, right?
It's kind of what all kids with parents who really want them to succeed. It's what, you know, it's the stage parent story, right? It really is. You know what I mean? He's Macaulay Culkin with bombs. No, not to say Macaulay, you know, we don't know about Macaulay Culkin's upcoming plans just in case.
Macaulay Culkin with bombs.
So
I think we have a t-shirt.
Oh my goodness, yes. So
it's at least a sticker.
No, so he joined the school in 1958. And so parents were asked to profile their children in little like snippets. And so Wanda, his mom, wrote, quote, "Much of his time is spent at home reading and contriving numerous gadgets made up of wood, string, wire, tape, lenses, gears, wheels, etc., that test our various principles in physics. His table and desk are always a mess of test tubes, chemicals, batteries, ground coal, etc. He will miss greatly, I think, this browsing and puttering in his messy makeshift lab." Mm-hmm. End quote. You know, it like sounds like my kind of childhood, but it doesn't, you know, he's going to miss his friends. He's going to miss his family, right? He's not going to miss his friends or family. He's going to miss his batteries and coal.
Yes, but he's looking forward to the chance to maybe get his hands on some high grade plutonium.
Yeah, maybe.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh Lord.
So originally when he goes to Harvard, he majored in physics, but then he switched over to mathematics. But at Harvard, he didn't particularly excel. Right. He maintained a B average, which, I mean, still, a 16-year-old at Harvard with a B average, heads and shoulders smarter than I am, right? Like, that kid's killing it right now. But he spent a tremendous amount of his time studying. He didn't really make close friends, but did have some kind of friends, just generally, like again, shallow kind of friendships. So he lived in a building. He lived in a building at 8 Prescott Street, which is outside of Harvard Yard. And this was a building that was designed specifically for what at the time was known as precocious undergrads, but which, you know, he lived in the freak dorm, right? Like he lived in the dorm for weirdos. He lived in the dorm of kids, of young kids, of kids from poor families, of, you know, kids from places that made them not fit into the kind of WASPy New England culture of entitlement and prestige and privilege, really, that Harvard had at the time, especially before it really tried to bring in more students of, you know, from different communities. Right. And so his roommates talk about how strange he was. They say he played trombone at all hours of the night, but they say he was pretty good. But when he was studying, he would rock back and forth rhythmically. And the noise it made would like drive them crazy, right? But again, there's like a clear shift in his way of behavior from freshman year to sophomore year and after, and that's kind of what comes into these experiments. But so this is a quote from The Atlantic. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a long quote, but this Atlantic article is really great. So there's going to be a couple long quotes. Quote: "Much has been made of Kaczynski's being a loner and of his having been further isolated by Harvard's famed snobism. Snobism was indeed pervasive at Harvard back then. A single false sartorial step could brand one an outcast, and Kaczynski looked shabby. He owned just 2 pairs of slacks and only a few shirts. Although he washed these each week in the coin-operated machine in the basement of the house next door to 8 Prescott, they became increasingly ragtag. But it is a mistake to exaggerate Kaczynski's isolation. Most public high schoolers at Harvard in those days, including Kaczynski, viewed the Tweedy in crowd as so many buttoned-down buffoons who did not realize how ridiculous they looked. And the evidence is that Kaczynski was neither exceptionally a loner nor, at least in his early years at Harvard, alienated from the school or his peers. Harvard was a tremendous thing for me," Kaczynski wrote in an unpublished autobiography that he completed in 98 and showed to me. "I got something that I had been needing all along without knowing it. Namely, hard work requiring self-discipline and strenuous exercise of my abilities. I threw myself into this. I thrived on it. Feeling the strength of my own will, I became enthusiastic about willpower. Freshmen were required to participate in sports, so Kaczynski took up swimming and then wrestling. He played the trombone as he had in high school, even joining the Harvard band, which he quit almost as soon as he learned that he would have to attend drill sessions. He played pickup basketball. He made a few friends. One of his housemates, Gerald Burns, remembers sitting with Kaczynski in an all-night cafeteria, arguing about the philosophy of Kant. After Kaczynski's arrest, Burns wrote to the anarchist journal Fifth Estate that Kaczynski was as normal as I am now. It was just harder on him because he was much younger than his classmates. And indeed, most reports of his teachers, his academic advisor, his housemaster, and the health services staff suggest that Kaczynski was in his first year at Harvard entirely balanced, although tending to be a loner. The health services doctor who interviewed Kaczynski as part of the medical examination Harvard required for all freshmen observed, good impression created, attractive, which seems a little weird for the doctor to write, but okay, attractive, mature for age, relaxed. Talks easily, fluently, and pleasantly. Likes people and gets on well with them. May have many acquaintances, but makes his friends carefully. Prefers to be by himself part of the time at least. Maybe slightly shy. Essentially a practical and realistic planner and an efficient worker. Exceedingly stable. Well integrated. And feels secure within himself. Usually very adaptable. May have many achievements and satisfactions. The doctor further described Kaczynski thus. Pleasant young man who is below usual college entrance age. Apparently a good mathematician, but seems to be gifted in this direction only. Plans not crystallized yet, but this is to be expected at his age. Is slightly shy and retiring, but not to any abnormal extent. Should be a steady worker, end quote. Boy, was that doctor wrong! you think he got egg on his face?
He was a steady worker. Gotta give him that.
He sure was a steady worker.
He was a very steady worker.
Well, so what's fascinating about this, right, is in his freshman year, he's just like a normal guy.
Well, yes, but this is also, again, so this is, I would say, somewhat removed from, especially like with doctors, like that doctor saw him once probably, right? So
right, and he was on his best behavior.
Yeah, and so it's like, and also I think whatever afflicted him may not have come, you know, to total fruition. Like if he was schizophrenic or anything along those lines, it hadn't shown itself yet at this stage. But I agree with you. Like there is nothing in this description of him that is any different than anyone else that is, you know, that is just a certain type of person going to college.
No. Right? And I can
playing the trombone. Which is kind of funny.
Which is apps. Can you just
and
imagine?
And then he was like, wait a minute, I have to go marching drills? No.
I was going to say, can you imagine him just like, right? Like ridiculous, absolute insanity. The thing that I find fascinating with this too is, and I think this speaks further to this, right? Is he appeared normal, like you're saying, right? He appeared normal, but that doesn't mean he was It doesn't mean he didn't have, like you were saying, underlying hints of a mental disorder or of violence or of anything else, right? A lot of people appear normal until they're not, you know. And I can speak from personal experience. Like, even if you are trying to like go to a doctor and say, "Hey, I think I'm a little bit more anxious than the normal person. I'd like a little help with this." They're like, you know. Most doctors are like, "Nah, you're probably not though. You're probably fine. You'll just deal with it." You know, it takes a lot of getting to know someone, because for a lot of these mental health issues, a tremendous part of the diagnosis is does it impact and affect daily life negatively?
Right.
And that you're not going to get, you know, everyone has little bits of mental tricks or mental errors or thinking errors or whatever that you can look up in the DSM-5 and say, "Oh my God, like this thing says, you know, what's that thing from Parks and Recreation when he looks up online what Leslie has and he's like, I think you have internet connectivity issues."
Oh, yes.
Or whatever, right? Like just a list of symptoms isn't useful. What you really need is how much does it actually affect your daily life? And so, anyways, I thought those quotes from the doctor were fascinating because, you know, looking back on it, like, I wonder if that doctor was like, I wonder where those notes are. You know, I'm just gonna pencil
in the Atlantic. Yeah.
I'm gonna pencil in something like he smells like gunpowder. I don't know what.
Well, especially at this time, somebody going to Harvard that was such a high achiever wouldn't necessarily be associated with mental illness.
No, they would right? not. I mean, in
this
general,
wasn't a diagnosis that you would be like looking for.
No,
you just weren't looking for it at all at this time. In a lot of ways, like, you know, he was well dressed. He came from a good family. He had this, you know, this outer veneer of quote unquote normalcy. If anything, he was gifted. He's just a little quiet.
No, right.
Right. It couldn't be anything wrong with him. There's everything right with him. Right. Right.
It's the late 50s, early 60s. If he had walked in there with a marijuana, you know, with smelling like weed, they would have been like, he's a communist reactionary. You know,
or if he had maybe brought in an African-American girlfriend, they would have had an issue with that.
Oh, yeah,
that would have been abnormal. But like, you know, and he looked mature, right? Too. He was tall. He looked mature, handsome. Again, fluent and pleasant. Until you're not.
So what's really interesting with this Atlantic piece and the book is that because the author went to Harvard at the same time, they're able to kind of develop a overview of kind of what it was that Ted was taught there. And so again, we got to remember this is the late 1950s, early 60s, right? This spans from 58 to 62, his years at Harvard. And so at this point, the government had kind of created what was known as the Red Book. And what this was it was a way to try and basically ensure that all American students at American universities were getting a good liberal political education.
Mm-hmm.
They were being taught to be good Americans, good capitalists. They were not being taught, you know, this is the point where, you know, Marxism on campus was still a kind of like a dirty kind of word. Right.
Yep.
But the thing was that there was a pushback, though, from those academics, because, you know, again, like a lot of our if you get into any kind of academic philosophy or any kind of academic, you know, psychology or sociology, anthropology, whatever, a lot of that liberal education that comes from those things is, you know, Marxism was extremely, was fundamental to a lot of those fields, or at least was very, very, you know, important to their development. And so to say that they couldn't teach ideas that weren't prescribed in this general education book, that was what the Red Book kind of put out there, right? To think that they would have to teach only Judeo-Christian morals and talk about, you know, their view of history and their view of science and their view of whatever, rankled a couple feathers. And so there was a real mismatch amongst the faculty between kind of this very positivist message and a more relativist message of, right? So on the one hand, you have the American way, red, white, and blue, we're always right. And, you know, capitalism is the answer and freedom is always a good thing. Democracy is the best, whatever.
Right.
And on the other hand,
teaching white history, like there's only very limited everything. Yes. One point of view.
And then on the other hand, you have the viewpoint of, you know, I mean, just think about the philosophers that were important at this time period. We're talking about people like Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre, right? Mm-hmm. Simone Beauvoir, like, these people were talking about how, and, you know, Carl Jung, like we were, these, the academics at the time were talking about how meaningless and how, you know, how humans were meat machines and there was no free will. And, you know, these ideas about technology being good for technology's sake were being questioned by every leading academic at the time.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe not in the sciences where they were making these big strides, but we had just dropped the atomic bombs.
Right.
We just saw the horrors that science and technology could do, both in the concentration camps, in just how, you know, think about like World War I and then World War II happened basically back to back. the amount of loss of life was staggering at that time period.
Yeah.
And we just kind of came down from this high of, you know, look at the cool bombs we could make to, oh my God, should we have this power?
Yes. And we're gearing up for more military conflict that's even murkier and harder to define, right? Going into the 60s.
Yeah. And so, so this is again, a larger quote from this Atlantic piece. And so what this is often described as is the Harvard culture of despair. And so what it did was set up this idea, two competing messages. The first was that science and technological progress was in its essence destructive for human beings. But two, that science and the drive for more technology was unstoppable. And it's kind of a very similar idea to what I think a lot of people in universities today get as well, depending on the field that they're in. Right. But it is still a very popular line of thinking. So this is again a quote from this. So quote, what impact did this reading have on us? Speaking as a college professor, as a former college professor, I can say that most curricula have absolutely no effect on most students, but readings can have a profound effect on some students, especially the brightest, most conscientious, and least mature. Certainly, the intellectual climate generated by Gen Ed informed Kaczynski's developing views. And so, sidebar, Gen Ed was the catch-all phrase for this kind of general education in liberal arts that was supposed to be given to all students. Mm-hmm. And so anyone in the United States has taken Gen Ed classes. They're still a thing. They've changed a little bit, right? I know I took a lot of Gen Ed classes. I know a lot about Renaissance
core curriculum. Core curriculum. It's to try and make you a well-balanced individual, if you will.
Exactly. So, okay.
You did not. And by the way, you did not take Renaissance. You do not know anything about Renaissance art anymore, do you?
No. But I did take a course on it, though. But I did not. Again, like this guy says, most curricula have absolutely no effect on most students, Marie. I was most students. All right. Quote. Certainly, the intellectual climate generated by Gen Ed informed Kaczynski's developing views. The Unabomber philosophy bears a striking resemblance to many parts of Harvard's Gen Ed syllabus. Its anti-technology message and its despairing depiction of the sinister forces that lie beneath the surface of civilization, its emphasis on the alienation of the individual and on the threat that science poses to human values, all these were in the readings. And these kinds of ideas did not affect Kaczynski alone. They reached an entire generation and beyond. Gen Ed had more than an intellectual impact. According to a study of Harvard and Radcliffe undergraduates that included Kaczynski's class of 1962, conducted by William G. Perry, Jr., the director of the university's Bureau of Study Council, the undergraduate curriculum had a profound impact on the emotions, the attitudes, and even the health of some students. According to Perry, intellectual development for Harvard and Radcliffe undergraduates typically encompassed a progression from a simplistic, dualistic view of reality to an increasingly relativistic and contingent one. Entering freshmen tend to favor simple over complex solutions and to divide the world into truth and falsehood, good and bad, friend and foe. Yet in most of their college courses, especially in the social sciences and the humanities, they're taught that truth is relative. Most accept this, but a number cannot. They react against relativism by clinging more fiercely to an absolute view of the world. To some of these students, in Perry's words, science and mathematics still seem to offer hope. Nevertheless, Perry wrote, regression into dualism is not a happy development, for it calls for an enemy. Dualists in a relativistic environment tend to see themselves as surrounded. They become increasingly lonely and alienated. This attitude requires an equally absolutistic rejection of any establishment, and can call forth in its defense hate, projection, and denial of all distinctions but one, Perry wrote. The tendency is towards paranoia. As is evident in his writings, Kaczynski rejected the complexity and relativism he found in the humanities and the social sciences. He embraced both the dualistic cognitive style of mathematics and Gen Ed's anti-technology message. And perhaps most important, he absorbed the message of positivism, which demanded value-neutral reasoning, and preached that, as Kaczynski would later express it in his journal, there was no logical justification for morality, end quote.
That's fascinating.
So to kind of break this down a little bit more for the listeners, right? there's this distinction they're making between dualism and relativism.
Mm-hmm.
Dualism is the idea that things are, that there is moral. No, so that's relativism. So dualism is.
Black or white.
Yeah. Dualism is there's moral and amoral. And so that would be things like philosophers say, like, it's basically imagine the world of most dogmatic religions, right?
Yes. Yes.
It's an idea that there are clear cut good guys and bad guys in the world. Yes. And that some of us do good and some of us do bad.
Yes.
Relativism says that morality is all relative to the society and the conditions that you're near or in. Right. Right. So, for instance, an example of this would be you're a starving kid on the streets of some city and you steal a loaf of bread. The dualist would say that you are amoral. Always. You should never steal because it's an absolute moral choice.
Right.
Whereas the relativist would say, you're starving, you needed to survive. You know, the relativist can have any kind of interpretation, right? All the way from, well, law and order is a illusion created by society, so you should just do whatever the hell you want. All the way to, you know, well, in the grand scheme of things, that loaf of bread is doing more good for you than it would do for that guy selling it. Or then the 25 cents or whatever that it would do for the guy selling it. And so it basically spans the chasm of all kind of moral theories from Unitarian or utilitarianism all the way to, say, nihilism or, you know,
right,
kind of existentialism or whatever. Whereas the dualist approach is really, again, this idea of there is a moral imperative. There is a strict code out there. Now, who sets the code? Who knows? But that there should be a strict moral code that you should always follow.
Right. And it's interesting because conspiracy theories mostly come from dualism.
Yeah.
They can be fueled and sort of influenced by relativism. Relativism could shade your views on certain interpretations of conspiracy theories, but conspiracy theories come from a reaction fear to something. Something is unknown. Something is different. It's you retreat from it and it becomes a narrative that is easier to understand. That's black or white.
Well, and what's interesting too, is that relativism itself is preached as a danger by a lot of conspiracy theorists. You know,
yes.
I mean, please, today we're going to get into it on our 15 minute episode, but you know, the argument against relativism, you know, that it's dangerous to have relative morals or whatever, like,
right.
It is part of the culture wars. You know what I mean? Really?
Yes.
And so it's still a fight that we're fighting.
Yes.
And
it's just sublimated in very strange ways.
Now. Right. Right.
It's not as apparent, I think. Sometimes.
No. And when people talk about, kind of, you know, the ivory tower liberal elitism of colleges.
Right.
They're talking about moral relativism.
Yes.
You know, the morality. But
they're talking about it in dualistic terms.
Exactly. Right?
It's very simplistic terms.
Yep. Now, actually, what's interesting is, and maybe they go over this in the book, or maybe this is pointed out in the book, but actually, I think what Kaczynski is most clearly influenced by, or maybe most clearly attacking, is the viewpoints of Henry Murray. And so Henry Murray is going to be, so at this point in time, Ted is he's a sophomore. He's getting through his gen ed curriculum. He's learning about kind of this shift in morality and these questions and whatever. And it is a very uncomfortable thing, I think, for a lot of students. I mean, I remember my first philosophy course I ever took in college. I had a really great professor who became really a mentor to me in my philosophy training. And it was this class that made me want to double major in philosophy. And so he, at the beginning of the class, he took people's names on cards. And then he spent the first session of class asking us questions about our opinions on things, and then essentially kind of arguing with us and seeing how strongly, or, you know, seeing what our viewpoints really were. And so it was for existentialism was the class. And so one of the students, he said to them, God is dead. How, you know, what do you think? Like, do you think God exists or not? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the student argued, you know, he's like, well, I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Christian. I was, you know, born, whatever. And just kind of given, you know, the normal stuff, whatever. And mm-hmm. then the professor kind of started to push back and say, well, you know, but there's lots of gods. Like, what if, and this kid just got up and left.
Yeah.
He was like, I'm not having this. And he just left and never came back.
If you think about college, though, in college now, like stepping back from general education curriculum of that time, college is when you start to, you're living on your own, you're self-regulating and self-managing, you're exposed to a lot of different people and a lot of different ideas, and these classes are presenting information and challenging you in a way that you probably haven't been challenged previously. And that's right. What I think is such a huge, I can't believe he got up and left. That's amazing.
It was.
I can imagine that, though. I could see that.
It was intense. And so he left, and the professor was like, well, I guess we're not getting that guy as a philosophy major.
Yeah.
It was like.
What? Hope he was pass fail. No, it's just.
Oh, my goodness. And so, okay. So Murray.
Yes.
Kaczynski is introduced to Murray. And Murray says to him, well, how would you like to be part of a study that I'm doing?
And so the study. Hey, son, you seem pretty bright.
You seem well adjusted and normal. How'd you like me to mess up your entire life? So the study itself, he is told that it pays pretty well to do it. It is going to be very important to science.
Mm-hmm.
And that. He can stop whenever he wants, but they're not told. They're told initially it'll only take a year.
Which is so effed up.
Actually, it's going to take 3 years. And so they're going to use these kind of the money. They're going to use the importance to science and how much help he's being and whatever to coerce him and the other students who are part of this thing to keep them in it. And so this is part of a larger unethical series of experiments the government performed called MK Ultra. Mm. Now it's not super clear if this test is part of MK Ultra itself or not. However, Henry Murray, the psychologist, had a long and storied history with the CIA and the OSS.
Yes.
So at this point in time, he was the head of the Harvard Psychological Clinic. And his research centered on personalities and how personalities are developed and how they can be altered by our surroundings. And then it could, as a continuation of that, how our personalities dictate our actions and our motivations to do actions. And so really, Murray is kind of the foundational figure in a field of psychology known as he called it personology, which is like terrible. I think it's a stupid name, but it's really, any kind of personality test you've taken for a job, any kind of one of those stupid things, you know, oh, I'm in J or whatever. All of that comes from
this
kind
called?
Of, that's called,
the Myers-Briggs.
Yeah. So they were also personologists. Essentially they worked off of Murray's kind of works right later on. So
this is, you know, so awful. We're going to do a diatribe about them sometime.
All of that comes from these kind of ideas that were developed around this time period. Now, so what he focused on was what's known as the dyad, what he called the dyad, which is the smallest social unit of two people. And how is it that this unit of two people, the smallest social unit, can affect the way that our personalities are shaped, are changed, and can we get to the center of someone's personality and thereby understand their motivations and how they will act in certain situations based on that interaction with another person? And so this work was of particular interest to the OSS, or the Office of Strategic Services. And so that is the original kind of version of the CIA. And so his first work for them actually was to try and develop a personality analysis of Adolf Hitler during World War II. Mm-hmm. And so actually his that work suggested that Hitler would likely commit suicide, said that Hitler was likely homosexual or at least had some kind of sexual difficulties.
Deviancy.
Yeah. You know, something like fetishism or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. and homosexuality at that time was considered something like that. But so his general idea or kind of his general framework for personalities was that you have your personality is basically set up as different mixes of needs and their kind of like you have. Okay. Every single person has set needs that they need to meet. Right. Mm-hmm. And the amount and the way that we meet those needs dictates our behavior. And so this is really coming from, again, really a very naturalist view, or kind of a, not naturalist is maybe the wrong word, a very fundamental view of humans as machines, right? That we have certain needs that have to be met, and the way that those are met develop everything else around us. And so he developed this idea of both primary and secondary needs. So the primary needs were called the viscerogenic, and the secondary were the psychogenic. So your primary needs are your physical needs, things like you need air, you need water, mm-hmm. you need food. To be able to pee and poop and breathe and right, all this other stuff. The secondary needs, and the secondary needs work a very similar way to the primary needs, are your psychic or your personality needs. And so these are 17 of them that belong to one of 8 domains. So there's the need for ambition, for materialism, for status, for power, for sadomasochism, for social conformance, for affection, and for information. And so some of those you've probably heard about, right? The drive for power
mm-hmm.
is used a lot to understand, let's say, people like Adolf Hitler, right? The need for social conformance is used to still develop buffet lines and grocery store aisles and
queue up. Right, yeah.
All these other things.
There's big money in figuring that stuff out nowadays.
Yeah. And so the way that your personality is developed is based on what are known as presses. And so these presses, what they do is they are basically environmental factors that interact with you. And then those presses determine which of your needs kind of gets clicked on,
mm-hmm.
right? Or which need you want to fulfill. And so you're always going to be trying to fulfill that need in some way. And so it's the need and that press from the environment, and there can be many of them at once, that then dictate your behavior and your motivation to act.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
It does.
Right.
We should just really quickly talk about why the OSS wanted to do this stuff. Like why MKUltra was funded, why it was important. Like why does the government care about these things?
Yeah. So the idea of these tests for Murray and why he was working mm-hmm. with the OSS was that they wanted to develop in these studies a way to basically brainwash and mm-hmm. obtain information from the minds of either their own people or captured spies.
Yes. And how can we make people into building blocks to understand how well and how susceptible they are to like clandestine operations?
Right.
How can we build things? How can we motivate people if we take them down to these most basic needs and wants? What makes somebody loyal? What makes somebody act? What's going to actually make them a good soldier for something yeah. like this?
So these are the stated goals of MKUltra, and this is from a document that was found by what was the Churchill Commission, I want to say.
Oh yeah. Churchill. Yep. Churchill
okay.
Commission.
So mm-hmm. so these are the goals, right? So okay. MKUltra was set up to obtain substances which will promote illogical thinking and impulsiveness to the point where the recipient would be discredited in public. substances which increase the efficiency of mentation and perception, materials which will cause the victim to age faster, slower in maturity, materials which will promote the intoxicating effect of alcohol, materials which will produce the signs and symptoms of recognized diseases in a reversible way, materials which will cause temporary or permanent brain damage and loss of memory, substances which will enhance the ability of individuals to withstand privation, torture, and coercion during interrogation and so-called brainwashing, materials and physical methods which will produce amnesia for events preceding and during their use, physical methods of producing shock and confusion over extended periods of time and capable of surreptitious use, substances which produce physical disablement, substances which will produce a chemical that can cause blisters, substances which alter personality structure in such a way the tendency of the recipient to become dependent upon another person is enhanced, a material which will cause mental confusion of such a type that individuals under its influence will find it difficult to maintain a fabrication under questioning.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Substances which will lower the ambition and general working efficiency of men. Substances which promote weakness or distortion of the eyesight or hearing. A knockout pill, which can be administered via food or aerosols. And a material which can be surreptitiously administered, which in very small amounts will make it impossible for a person to perform physical activity. They were essentially trying to create, either through the use of drugs, through the destruction and deconstruction of someone's personality, or through other, you know, torture, sexual torture, you know, they were trying to find a way basically to both make their agents completely impossible to break and find a way to break the agents of another country.
They wanted the control switch is how I look at it, right? They wanted the ultimate, how do we make these people do what we want them to do, whatever it is. I think an interesting thing to bring up at this point, one of the main drugs they used, LSD, we didn't talk about it earlier, but Timothy Leary was at
Harvard.
Harvard the same time.
Yeah.
He had some sort of interactions with Murray.
Well, Murray was the head of the department, so his studies had to be.
But like, Timothy, that's crazy. Sorry.
No. So that's the thing with a lot of these things is that even say Kaczynski's records from these studies are still under seal. Like, he was never able to receive them. The writer of this book was not able to get them. You know, so it's still highly kind of held close to the chest. And there's still questions today about, you know, I mean, look at the Cuba, the sound weapon, right? Or the supposed sound weapon. Like,
oh, yeah, that one. Yeah, no, the sonic weapon. Yeah. So-called sonic weapon. Yes.
There's a lot of things still that people wonder, you know, well, is this
could
stuff?
Could this be? Yeah.
Is
could
it still you do going this? On? And yeah, so in part sort of
spycraft. Really quickly, right, too. Interesting thing about Timothy Leary. I mean, Timothy Leary had a lot of the same exposure that Kaczynski ended up going through. However, what happened to him was totally different. Like, he became sort of a cultural icon for the 60s and 70s with Tune In, Turn On, and Drop Out, right? Yeah. Like, that he was advocating not just leaving institutions like Harvard, but society in total. So still sort of that anti-establishment, anti-industrialism, anti-everything mindset. But a lot of what MK Ultra started to foster, and even I would argue the general education, was the hippie movement, right? Was absolutely. The whole rebirth of this type of critical thinking.
Which is hilarious because they these things were set up specifically to try to they were set up to control people and it didn't work.
Right.
What's fascinating with Leary too is that his work was specifically on the administration of psilocybin, which is the chemical that's in magic mushrooms, and is the precursor to LSD. And so he was part of two especially interesting ones. The Concord State Prison Experiment and the Marsh Chapel Experiment, which again, these are considered extremely unethical by today's standards. By today's standards. And so in these experiments, what was going on was that these people were being administered at least in the Marsh Chapel Experiment, they were told they would be taking this drug, but not what it would do. But so in these experiments, so in the first one, the Concord State Prison Experiment, they were administering magic mushrooms to prisoners to see what effect it would have on their recidivism rate, on their rate of re-offending in public. Mm-hmm. It had no effect. And then the Marsh Chapel experiment, they administered this drug to see if it would give people religious experience, and it did. It made a lot of people, there were some famous theologians in the group, actually, that would later say, you know, this was a transformative. Like, this was the lightning bolt that made me feel like God was in my life. Mm-hmm. And so today, in kind of modern science, we're starting to reassess the use of actually psilocybin on things like, say, clinical depression that's difficult to treat by other means, or on schizophrenia, or on other kinds of things. But for a long time, it was really, I think, tarnished by... its use medically was tarnished by these clandestine experiments where in many cases, they were administering these drugs to unwitting subjects. They were just putting them in people's coffee and seeing what they
testing
did.
Testing them on unwitting, like you said, unwitting towns.
Yes.
Absolutely inmates. Insanity. It's crazy. But the thing too is I think what they did not have an understanding of was what are the long-term effects of these drugs? What, if you start to mix them with other drugs, what happens? Like, I don't think that they had a very good roadmap.
No.
For any of that. Because it is, in this book, in the Alston Chase book, he talks about how Murray was addicted to amphetamines.
Well, yeah, I mean, Murray, he's the one that came up with, you don't get high on your own supply. I mean, he's the guy that wrote that. He wrote that.
But I mean, I think that there is something very, just if nothing else, there is something very troubling about the person who is administering and working with college kids for 3 years being completely, completely out of control on quote unquote illicit substances.
Well, at the time, they still thought amphetamines were like, they thought this was like the pill that helped the Nazis, you know, continue their work or whatever. Right. Like, whatever. We could do a whole episode. We could do a whole episode on amphetamines, not on amphetamines, amphetamines.
Well, we could do a whole episode on drugs. That would be hysterical.
All right. So this is a quote. So again,
our mothers listen to this show. We can't.
They sure do.
We shouldn't be doing that.
So
no electric Kool-Aid acid test for us, sir.
Oh, God. Okay. So Murray was, again, this test with Ted did not administer drugs. It was purely based on personality deconstruction. But so this is, again, a quote from that Atlantic article. So, quote, Murray's interest in the dyad, which, again, if you remember, is that social unit of two people, however, may have been more than merely academic. The curiosity of this complex man appeared to have been impelled by two motives, one idealistic and the other somewhat less so. He lent his talents to national aims during World War II. Forrest Robinson, the author of a 1992 biography of Murray, wrote that during this period he flourished as a leader in the global crusade of good against evil. He was also an advocate of world government. Murray saw understanding the dyad, it seems, as a practical tool in the service of the Great Crusade in both its hot and cold phases. He had long shown interest, for example, in the whole subject of brainwashing. During the war, Murray served in the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the CIA, helping to develop psychological screening tests for applicants and, according to Timothy Leary, monitoring military experiments on brainwashing. In his 1979 book, John Marks reported that General Wild Bill Donovan, the OSS director, called in Harvard psychology professor Henry Harry Murray to devise a system for testing the suitability of applicants to the OSS. Murray and his colleagues put together an assessment system that tested a recruit's ability to stand up under pressure, to be a leader, to hold liquor, to lie skillfully, and to read a person's character by the nature of his clothing. Murray's system became a fixture in the OSS. One of the tests that Murray devised for the OSS was intended to determine how well applicants withstood interrogations. As he and his colleagues described it in their 1948 report, Selection of Personnel for Clandestine Operations, Assessment of Men, the candidate immediately went downstairs to a basement room. A voice from within commanded him to enter, and on complying, he found himself facing a spotlight strong enough to blind him for a moment. The room was otherwise dark. Behind the spotlight sat a scarcely discernible board of inquisitors. The interrogator gruffly ordered the candidate to sit down. When he did so, he discovered that the chair in which he sat was so arranged that the full strength of the beam was focused directly on his face. At first, the questions were asked in a quiet, sympathetic, conciliatory manner to invite confidence. After a few minutes, however, the examiner worked up to a crescendo in a dramatic fashion. When an inconsistency appeared, he raised his voice and lashed out at the candidate, often with sharp sarcasm. He might even roar, "You're a liar." Even anticipation of this test was enough to cause some applicants to fall apart. The authors wrote that one person insisted he could not go through with the test. They continued. A little later, the director found the candidate in his bedroom, sitting on the edge of his cot, sobbing. End quote.
That's some good stuff.
That is almost to the T, the test that was done to Kaczynski. So this is a quote from a Mental Floss article that describes, I think, kind of very well the what happened in that room. And so this is by Stacey Conrad from April 3rd, 2015, again from Mental Floss. So it says, quote, "In the tests, Kaczynski and 21 other students were told to develop their personal philosophies on life. Then they would debate that philosophy against another undergraduate student, who, as it turns out, this is not from this, as it turns out, though, was a lawyer, was a trained lawyer. As it turned out, this was no friendly discourse. When they showed up to debate, the test subjects were attached to electrodes, seated in a chair facing a one-way mirror, and subjected to hot, bright lights. The debate wasn't with a fellow undergrad at all, but a law student who had been told to go to town on the ideals of these young men. To make matters worse, they then had to watch a video of the argument after it was over, which forced them to go through the humiliation all over again. Murray himself called them vehement, sweeping, and personally abusive attacks." End quote.
Can I read you something interesting about Murray himself?
Absolutely.
Which, to me, makes this even more ironic and interesting.
Sure.
And this was something that I went back and found. So he was notorious for having a very thin skin. And the quote goes, "Some suggested that he feared to publish because it would expose him to criticism, which he couldn't tolerate. For he did indeed have a very thin skin. He made a charming initial impression, an extraordinary good listener. He could appear utterly enthralled by someone he just met. Yet at the first sign that this worship was not requited, he turned, often cruelly, on the other person. The great Murray," wrote a former colleague, "didn't like anyone to leave him. He liked to be the one to leave. And I think that that's, like, the book goes on to say that he took everything personally. And here's another good one. "He couldn't keep his feelings and science apart and was unable to decide whether he was a humanist exploring his own soul or a scientist studying the psyches of others."
Yeah, not, I mean, overall, just these tests. So
he couldn't even stand up himself under that test.
Under that kind of testing. No, of course not. Of course not. Because it must have been, you know, I think that's true for a lot of, you know, I mean, science is very personal, right? I mean, we like to think of it as, we say it a lot on the show, right? We like to think of it as this kind of separate thing from our personalities or our behavior, but really
it is science,
not. Science and scientists are human, right? So, you know, the idea that his ideas would have been greatly developed by his personal, the fact that he himself couldn't undergo this kind of evaluation probably had a lot to do with why he developed it in the first place.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? To say,
he's why, fixed on speed, putting a bunch of kids through this for, you know, lying to them and putting the, you know, putting them through it for 3 years. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Well, so what continue. You can imagine then is, you know, and again, these went on for hours, these sessions. Mm. And you're under a hot light. You're strapped into a chair. You got this guy just berating you, just picking apart all of your ideas about, you know, you're stupid, you're silly, you know, you're so naive mm-hmm. to think this stupid thing, just tearing these students apart. And then afterwards, you have to watch your humiliation again. You can't leave the room, right? And this was all developed to see how you withstood, I mean, torture, personality torture. And really, I think you see the effects of this, first off, distinctly in how Ted changed in Harvard after that point, but also in the way that his worldview gets crystallized into almost the antithesis of what Murray likely believed, right? And also taking into this, so again, this idea here about what Murray's idea was is, let's take the example of food, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a need to take in food. And so you'll become hungry. And depending on the factors around you, you know, you will develop different means of action to satisfy that need for food. So if you're near a river, maybe you'll go fishing. Or if you're in a forest, maybe you'll pick berries. Or if you're in an area where there's a lot of predation, maybe mm-hmm. you'll scavenge.
Or right? if you're in Chicago, you get a hot dog or pizza.
Yeah. You know, get inferior pizza to East Coast pizza.
Oh. Right?
To New York pizza. Like maybe you do that.
Cold.
Maybe do that bad thing.
Our own psychological warfare.
So the idea with these psychic needs is that you also have psychic needs, like the need for affirmation. And so you will try to find some way to be affirmed, to be told mm-hmm. you're good, to be told that you're doing a good thing, or you're doing great, sweetie. You know, you're going to try to find that need. You're going to find a way to fill that need some way. And depending on the social pressures around you, you will find a way to meet that need in different ways. And now all of us have those needs that we have to fulfill in some way, but some of us have different ratios of those needs. So, you know, some of us are maybe more ambitious than others, and maybe that suggests that we have, those of us that are more ambitious, have more of a drive for power or a drive for affirmation, right?
Yes.
So we all have them, and our society instills in us different, you know, in some ways it's a circular kind of system where your social pressures and your upbringing and whatever, as well as your brain chemistry, dictate how those needs will be developed. And then over time, those needs are continuously reinforced by your social pressures around you, right?
Yes. All the way through corporate America where you do the Myers-Briggs.
Well, exactly,
we just had
right?
one that, yeah, talking about like ambition and how do you motivate someone?
Right. And so, that's all of that came from Murray. Right. And so
sick bastard.
And so here are the needs that he has. Right. And so he has a need for, and then the representative behavior that suggests this. Right. So the need for superiority is represented by to seek validation of power. Okay. The need for achievement is to accomplish difficult tasks. The need for recognition is to get praise and commendation. The need for exhibition is to impress others through one's actions and words, even if these are shocking. The need for acquisition is to have possession of an object. The need for conservance is to maintain the condition, right? So we're going to skip some of these because some of these are not important. But so the need for infavoidance is to avoid failure and humiliation. The need for defendance is to defend oneself against attack or blame. The need for seclusion is to be isolated from others. The need for dominance is to control one's own environment. The need for autonomy is to resist the influence of others and strive for independence. And then the next, I think, really kind of important one here is the need for aggression, which is to forcefully overcome, control, punish, or harm someone. Okay. Kaczynski will write in the manifesto about how society pressures people into being a certain way, that people's personalities naturally want to be a certain way, and that society causes them to kind of uncomfortably fit into this box of technology, so that technology is no longer being molded to fit the needs of humans, but the other way around is happening, where humans are being fit to the needs of technology. So you can imagine the argument would be something like, it is again a very famous Karl Marx quote, right? Society with the wheelbarrow gives us serfdom and feudalism. Society with the coal steam engine gives us capitalism. That technology in some way is shaping human behavior in a way that wasn't the case before. And so this is again from Harvard and the Making of the Unabomber in the Atlantic, quote, "This evolution towards a civilization increasingly dominated by technology and the power structures serving technology, the manifesto argues, cannot be reversed on its own because technology is a more powerful social force than the aspiration for freedom. And because while technological progress as a whole continuously narrows our sphere of freedom, each new technical advance considered by itself appears to be desirable. Hence, science and technology constitute a mass power movement, and many scientists gratify their need for power through identification with this mass movement. Therefore, the technophiles are taking us all on an utterly reckless ride into the unknown. Because human beings must conform to the machine, our society tends to regard as a sickness any mode of thought or behavior that is inconvenient for the system. And this is plausible because when an individual doesn't fit into the system, it causes pain to the individual as well as problems for the system. Thus, the manipulation of an individual to adjust him to the system is seen as a cure for a sickness and therefore is good." End quote. It's like he's reading... You know, he's using words that Murray used in his writings, right? He's talking about the need for power, the need for dominance, the need for freedom, and how in modern society, the need for power is being over, or the need for freedom is overcome by the need for power and dominance over nature.
Right. But you are almost subservient to something that is never going to be, you're never going to be able to get past, right? It's always, again, technology is always going to never serve you. You will always serve it.
Exactly. And that's why he, that's why he basically says it has to be violent. It has to be, you know,
it has to be a jarring effect. Yeah.
Basically what he'll argue in the manifesto is that this system will collapse eventually based just on the, you know, society will become so desperate and so unhappy that the society will by necessity collapse in on itself for something better.
Because even if you think about Moore's law about improvement for, you know, for just with technological advances, like it gets that much faster. It gets that able to move that much quicker, but you will always, no matter how advanced you are as a person, you will never get past that.
Well, so yeah, so it's diminishing returns. It's diminishing returns, right? Like what you're saying.
Yeah.
He's arguing that, okay, the first technological advancement, you know, cures polio. And that helps way more people than it hurts. The new technical advancement, you know, I get to see Kylie Jenner on my Facebook feed and I get to sell my privacy, right? Like, you know, the benefit, the cost
and
benefit.
We've just turned a corner into arguing No, I'm just joking.
No.
But so, yes, I agree with you.
The cost benefit of technology diminishes over time. And so his argument would be, and this is the argument again, like reading this from the point of view of someone who is, anyone who's read any kind of philosophy, anyone who's really been involved in, say, like, you know, just academic thinking, anyone who's gone to college could write the manifesto. It's, you know, these aren't particularly, like, that's the thing that's so fascinating about this is how shallow the thoughts really are. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, but I do also think that there is something to it. Like, the interesting thing about Kaczynski was that he did predate, like, Silicon Valley, right? He predated sort of what we could see as technology actually surpassing the good of people, even beyond, like, a singularity or something like that, right? It's like you said, like, Facebook and privacy and things, and, you know, and possible overturning of democracies. I mean, that's really what, you know, he couldn't have foreseen, but he did in a lot of ways. I think, too, interestingly, I don't know if his viewpoint in this manifesto is a rebuking of Murray as much as it is almost a springboard, or he's actually taken everything that this did to him and is just, you know, double barreling it back on the system that was Harvard, on the system that let somebody come to power to do this. And it's, I think that there is, you know, before reading this and even having this discussion, I didn't give as much credence to this event as I am now. I think it's interesting that other people, it would be really interesting to find out, like, the dudes who weren't Kaczynski that went through this whole thing.
Right. How do they turn out?
They're all investment bankers. No, I'm joking. I don't know, well, right?
What's
congressmen
interesting,
and investment bankers.
What's interesting is, so I guess, first off, so one thing first. I guess what I meant is that looking at it from today's point of view, it appears shallow. But you're right. At the time, he was basically part of the general, this was well within the realm of academic normalcy, right? This manifesto does not, you know, the turn to violence is the part that makes it, clear that he is, you know,
not well,
not well in the sense that any criminal is not well, right?
Right.
But the thoughts themselves at the time, and even today, you know, at the time were still somewhat revolutionary and interesting and whatever, but today are very passé because this is the argument that we've, you know, philosophers have been making this argument for the last 30 years, you know? So anyways, this, and I think the other point that I wanted to make was, I think you're right that he's not necessarily, he's using Murray's ideas, right? He's clearly drawing from those ideas. And so I don't think he's trying to refute Murray's ideas themselves about the psyche and our personalities. What I think he's arguing against, I think Murray in some ways had the idea that, and maybe this is just a misreading of him, but I don't think he would have been involved in these tests about personality and everything else if he didn't believe that technology, you know, the ends justified the means.
Well, but you would be able to control someone, I think, is where he made the big mistake. Like, we're going to break MK Ultra and Murray. We're going to break someone down. And then we are going to be able to do whatever we want with them. And they're going to be controllable. I think that's the error in a lot of ways, because they broke someone down and they lost control over what this person was capable of doing.
Right. Well, the idea that we could use these societal pressures and things on someone Kaczynski is essentially saying, well, then I just won't be part of society. You know, like that's fine with me. And actually in the Netflix series about the Unabomber, the making of the Unabomber, he even mentions to, and you know, we're going to get into this more when we talk about the FBI hunt for him and everything else. But he talks about, you know, the perfect example of Marie's theories is you're driving home at night. It's 3 a.m. There's no one on the road. And you see a red light on the road in front of you. Do you stop at the red light? Why? Why would you? Right? There's no reason to stop at the red light. There's no cars coming. It's 3 a.m. You're the only one on this road. Right? You're not going to get caught. You're not harming anyone by going through the light. But most people won't. Most people will stay at the red light. And they'll feel bad if they go through the red light.
Myself included, by the
way. Oh, me too.
Oh my God. Yeah, no.
You know, but that's society's coercive action on you. That's a pressure from society acting on your need for conformance, right? Or your need to be lawful.
Yes, exactly. Me buying into the idea of the social good. I'm going to stop at this red light because if I don't, I could hurt someone else. Even if there's no one out there, I still will be responsible.
Right, but I think that's a big part of the idea of the manifesto, too, is that that itself is just a story you're telling
it's
yourself.
It's an illusion.
Right? Yeah. Yes. So, all right. So, anyways, we're gonna break apart our own theory. You know, we're going to break apart our own psyches next episode a little bit more.
I'm moving to Montana, people.
So, he freshman year, he's normal. The next 3 years, he spends at Elliott House in a seven-person suite with a bunch of guys that come to know him as just a total weirdo, right? So this is the thing, too. These seven people were like a ragtag group in this house full of the richest, preppiest people at Harvard.
Yeah.
Right? So this is actually a quote from one of his suite mates from the New York Times article that we've been quoting throughout the series. He goes, quote, Ted's room had a good view of the river, but I never saw anybody live in such an unkempt place, Mr. McIntosh said. In some places, the papers and such were a foot deep. That disturbed me that someone could live in such filth. The worst part was when it began to smell. Maybe it was rancid milk. End quote. He becomes, like, his views on society, on wanting to become a recluse, on wanting to move out into the wilderness, are crystallized in this time period. That's without doubt. Yeah. You know, that this is really the period that brings him out. And this difference between his freshman year and his continued kind of, you know, almost dissolution into this other person that we would know as the Unabomber is very, very fascinating. You know, and so, again, we can't say for certain. I don't think anyone can say for certain. And this is true of anyone's life that this was the defining moment. Right? His mother thought it was hives. Other authors now think it is these tests on Henry Murray. Next episode, there's going to be something else that we'll point to. Who knows?
But I mean, or was he always going to be the Unabomber, right? Was this an inevitable thing that if it wasn't hives, if it wasn't this, if it wasn't that, he would have been this person? Or does this person exist in anyone and it just takes the right amount of coercion to bring it out?
Right. The push to make you.
Right. Yes.
Into this person.
Or even, yes. Not us. We're fine.
Oh, we're totally fine. So, so then he graduates. 1962, he graduates. Hooray! And he decides to go off to graduate school. And so this is where we're going to pick up next episode is graduate school, his mathematics work, and his descent into bombings. And kind of how that happens, which is going to be a lot of fun. Now, actually, I wanted to close out this episode with some funny anecdotes. So he actually was really funny in all of the Harvard yearbooks for like the 20th reunion and whatever. So for the 20th, so by the way, so he graduated with a degree in mathematics. Mm-hmm. He just turned 20.
God.
He never said anything really. Again, that autobiography was never published.
Right.
He doesn't really say a lot about Harvard or his classmates or whatever, besides, you know, I kind of liked it, whatever. He does explicitly say he did not like the testing of Murray and would like those records released. But I think a part of that is more he wants to know what Murray thought of him.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I bet you're right.
So for the 20th and 25th reunions of Harvard class of 62, he listed his address as 788 Banchet Pesh, Kadar Kel, Afghanistan. And then for the 50th reunion, while he was in prison as the Unabomber, he actually also wrote in about himself. So he wrote Theodore John Kaczynski, home address number 04475-046, U.S. Penitentiary Max, P.O. Box 8500, Florence, Colorado, occupation prisoner, house/dorm Elliot, degrees, a Bachelor of Arts, 62, a master's degree from the University of Michigan in 65, and then a PhD in 67. Publications, technical slavery. Awards, 8 life sentences issued by the United States District Court for the Eastern District of California, 1998.
Wow. So is he being funny or is he being serious? Because he does feel like he needs to have that recognition.
I think he's being hilarious.
Well, I mean, it is hilarious. I would hope that's the case. But then, you know, that's a... God.
That being a little arch. Being a little arch.
Being a little arch. I will give you that.
Anyways.
He lost that milkiness. I will say this, you know, there's no milkiness coming out of that Harvard grad.
That milk curdled into a hard edge.
It did. Right. And it stunk up the joint, clearly.
Jesus Christ. All right, dear listeners, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Mad Scientist Podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode, 3 of 4, on the Unabomber. As always, this episode is copyright the Mad Scientist Podcast and Damage Hippie Productions.
Stay in school?
Or move to the woods, I guess. I don't really know. Thank you again, dear listeners, for listening to the Mad Scientist Podcast. I have been your host, Chris Cogswell, joined by my co-host,
Marie Mayhew.
If you'd like to contact the show, please send us an email at themadscientistpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word. You can also follow us on Twitter at MadScientistPod or at Team Giant Squid for Marie. And of course, you can see us on Facebook, on Instagram, and all over the internet as the Mad Scientist Podcast. And again, our logo is the one with the pumpkin head, so it's easy to see.
Mm-hmm.
If you've enjoyed the show tonight, please consider supporting us on Patreon, where the money that you give to us will help us to promote this show further, to make it better, and just to spend more time making it.
Because we love doing that.
We do love doing that. Our logo was designed by Carrie Shaheen. Our web design is done by Desdemona Howard.
Woohoo!
And our sound design is done by Jake Cardinal. Thanks again for listening.
Thank you. This has been a Damn It Chippy production.
Hey there. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey.
We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema.
Our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.